Welcome to the Week in 60 Minutes from Spectator TV, recorded on Thursday, January the 21st. This week, Joe Biden becomes president on his third attempt. We'll look at what to expect from the Biden administration. Britain's vaccine rollout continues to general acclaim, but has it slowed recently? And what should the government do about those who don't want to be vaccinated? And Russian opposition politician Alexei Navalny returned to Moscow and was immediately arrested. What to make of this brave and provocative figure? If you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel, and why wouldn't you? It's free. You'll never miss a program. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen now. Now, before we begin, a very special thanks to Charles Stanley for their continued support of The Week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest companies on the London Stock Exchange. We're delighted that they're our partners here at Spectator TV. First, America has a 46th president, the oldest ever to take office and in the most unprecedented of circumstances. With mobs rampaging through Capitol Hill, the pandemic still raging in the country, and deep divisions across the nation. Is President Trump really the right antidote to 4 years? So is President Biden really the right antidote to 4 years of Mr. Trump? I'm joined by Kate Andrews, a resident American who's penned a hopeful cover piece for the magazine this week. Kate, you said that Biden was lucky, unlucky. What do you mean by that?
This is a quote from former Senator Ted Kaufman in Evan Osnos's biography of Joe Biden published late last year, in which he says that Joe Biden is both the unluckiest and luckiest man he's ever met. The former, he's referring to the personal tragedies that Joe Biden has experienced. He lost his first wife and his infant daughter in a car crash right before he was first sworn into the Senate. And he, of course, lost his son, Beau Biden, several years back, very early as well. So this is a man who's experienced great tragedy. And on the other side, a lot of political luck. Despite running for the presidency twice and having failed presidential bids, he now finds himself securing more votes for a presidential candidate than any other candidate in history. He has found himself in the White House in the most fragile and difficult of times, but actually things could be looking up relatively soon. He's coming in when vaccines have been secured, the development of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine in the States, which is a one-dose vaccine that needs to be stored at fridge temperatures, could be a real game changer. You can take that into rural America, go door to door. And the economy is expected, once people are properly inoculated, to start surging again. So whilst things look very bleak now, Joe Biden might be overseeing a spectacular economic rebound and a falling death toll in America mere months coming into the job.
So it could be by the autumn, by the fall, the Biden administration could be over the worst of the pandemic, particularly, as you say, with the Johnson & Johnson virus. It's a one-dose one, as you point out. And the economy could be recovering at a fair whack. So stick for 6 months and it could start to look quite good for the Biden administration.
It really could. And one would argue that that doesn't have a lot to do with Joe Biden. It has to do with developments that were made before he entered the Oval Office, but still he's going to benefit from them. But the real task ahead of Joe Biden isn't governing. It isn't any particular piece of legislation. It is bringing America back together, as the social fabric of the country is just in tatters. And it's clear that Biden understands the weight of that responsibility since he was elected, certainly in his inauguration speech this week. His whole message is one of unity. He made very clear he will be a president for all Americans, regardless of whether or not you voted for him, that he takes this task, he said, into his soul, and that it is his job to unite the country. He will be tested on these words, however, when he has to start speaking to the Republicans, reaching across the aisle and compromising to get his legislation through. Now, because the Democrats have secured a very small majority in the Senate, they could start ramming through pieces of legislation, albeit watered down because many of these votes require 60 votes, and then you do need some of the minority party to come onto your side. Or, as Biden says, he hopefully won't have to do that. He will speak to Republicans. But this is about to be tested, whether or not Biden's serious about his message of unity, but also whether or not the Republicans are ready to come and meet him halfway. Obviously, this is a party that is really shell-shocked at the moment and pretty much a mess on the floor.
I think it's quite hard to see Mr. Biden as a sort of FDR kind of figure, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who did do a lot to bring the country together in the Great Depression after he was elected in 1932. But it may be beyond even an FDR. We see the number of people who voted for Mr. Trump, who still think the election was stolen. Even a minority of those who voted for Mr. Trump were not prepared to criticize the mob that rampaged through Capitol Hill. We see an element of the Democrats wanting to set up a sort of blacklist of anybody who ever worked or was close to Mr. Trump. And of course, the congressional Democrats anxious to continue with the impeachment. It's a, you know, the rhetoric was fine at the inauguration, Kate, but it's a tough job to heal America at the moment.
Very difficult. And the cover piece speaks to this week, because Joe Biden is very much alone in his party in wanting to find consensus, wanting to find center ground. Many in the Democrat Party see this as an opportunity to lurch to the left, to get their policies through, and really to point the finger of blame at not specifically the mob that raided the Capitol building and President Donald Trump, but to point it at all Republicans, the representatives, even potentially those who voted for him. We're talking about 74 million Americans. Joe Biden doesn't want to do this, but he's going to be fighting his own party as much as he's going to be fighting the Republicans. And, you know, it's quite unfortunate, Andrew, but I think you're right that the task is so big, it's not obvious that he can do it on his own. I think to see real recovery and trust in the institutions again, to bring back the millions of Americans who still believe that this election was fraudulent, despite there being no evidence for that, is going to take more than simply the president. It's frankly going to take a Republican Party to own up to the mess that it made, and for a lot of those representatives to change their tune. Going into the midterm election in 2 years' time, there has to be a completely different attitude before people start voting as to how we're going to treat the outcome of that race. And you know, the president cannot do that on his own. It's going to require everybody to pitch in. And I'm not sure there is appetite, as you say, for people to do it right now.
Well, I think you raise an important point. It takes two to tango. And we don't yet know if the Republican Party is going to reform itself in a post-Trump way that makes it possible for a moderate Biden administration to reach across the aisle in a number of areas. I mean, there is an appetite among Mr. Biden's people to do that, certainly those closest to him, but it's not sure who they are going to be able to reach, who's going to be there when they reach across the aisle. And we still don't know, Kate, either. Is it going to be a post-Trump Republican Party? I mean, does Mr. Trump, no longer having his social media, does he just disappear into his Mar-a-Lago redoubt in a morass of litigation and debt-fueled financial problems? Or does he see himself as coming as a second coming? We don't know any of that.
We don't. The president indicated in his last speech before he left for Florida that he would be back. We don't know what that looks like yet. We don't know if that's creating a new political party. There are whispers of that. Essentially, that would be to the detriment of the Republican Party, because he would be splitting votes. It's a little bit hard for me to believe that Donald Trump would want to put himself forward in politics again if he didn't think he could really win. That would be pure vengeance, but let's not put it past him. We don't know if that might be on a media platform that he creates himself now that he's been booted off the mainstream ones. But as you say, Andrew, this is going to be a real divide in the Republican Party. On the one hand, you have Republicans who are going to be wooed by those 74 million votes that came in for the president, who see opportunities in a few years' time potentially to take control of Congress again. And then on the other hand, you have people like the former Governor Nikki Haley, who also served as ambassador to the UN for the United States, who is very keen to distance the Republican Party from Donald Trump, is being critical of the president, and actually has been for years. It's going to be interesting with no designated party leader in opposition like you have here in the UK. This is going to be a lot of infighting, and voters are going to decide which kind of candidate they want to promote in 2 or 4 years' time. So we're going to be watching that play out. In terms of maybe some bipartisan areas, I think the appointment of Avril Haines, the first woman to be the national security chief, that has been praised from both the Republican and Democratic sides. And I think the main reason is because she's tough on China. And one thing that's becoming clear in this Biden administration, again, we'll see if rhetoric lines up with action, is that they're not necessarily going to back away from Trump's stance on China. I mean, he'll be more diplomatic. You won't see as many social media spats. But this is an area where Republicans and Democrats are probably going to continue to unite around, broadly speaking, what President Trump was getting at in his 4 years, which is that a tougher stance has to be taken.
And I think it's clear that Mr. Biden is not going to junk the Trump agenda entirely. He's going to pick up on it. He's going to keep tax breaks for those lower paid that Mr. Trump gave, keep the criminal justice reforms that happened under Mr. Trump. Interesting, too, that he's talking about the added stimulus as being, as you point out in your article, Kate, an extension of what Mr. Trump had done. And of course, a tougher line with China, which started under Mr. Trump, now seems to be the Washington consensus. So that may help. I was struck, Kate, just as a final point, by how you said in your cover story that if you take, you know, Mr. Biden did not win by a landslide by any means. He's got a very slim majority in the House. Indeed, it's a little, Democrats, a little smaller majority than it was before the election. He depends on the vice president's casting vote in a 50-50 Senate. You add all that up, and it's a little bit like the American equivalent of a British hung parliament. And that would suggest, Kate, to me, that actually you're only going to get things done if you, in these circumstances, if you deal from the center ground.
Yes, and to be fair, this is what Joe Biden's experience in Washington, D.C. has been for decades now. Famously, when President Obama was unable to negotiate with the Republicans, he'd send in Joe. And Joe very often managed to find that center ground. So he knows better than anybody else what it takes to get meaningful legislation over the line, and that is some level of bipartisan support. It's worth pointing out that Senator Chris Coons was up for the job of Secretary of State. He's a senator from Delaware, very chummy with Joe Biden, and Biden actually has left him in the Senate almost so to be his whisperer to the GOP, because Coons has a very good reputation, as Biden did, in reaching out to the other side. It's something he clearly prioritizes. He knows from a history in Washington that you cannot get meaningful things done without support from the other side. So I do think he's genuine when he says that that will be his goal. But he has his own party fighting him as well as the Republican Party. And in that sense, he stands quite lonely, albeit in front of an American people that just overwhelmingly did elect his ticket to go to Washington to enter the Oval Office and to start doing the job.
Kate, thanks for that. You can read Kate's cover story in this week's edition of The Spectator. And remember, if you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel for free, you never miss another episode. You just click the subscribe button at the bottom of the right of the screen now. Now, Britain's vaccine rollout per capita continues to storm ahead of most other nations, with around 5 million vaccinations likely by this weekend. The success has roiled much of Britain's media, which is often at its happiest, revealing weaknesses in the government's pandemic response, and there has been plenty of them. So this week it had to console itself by wondering aloud if Pfizer's supplies had slowed down. And of course, it fell back on its old favorite chestnut, postcode lottery, failing to understand that unless you keep a central grip on the rollout, as they have in Scotland, which has hardly been a success story, then some regional variation is inevitable, and it's not always the result of incompetence either. But before we get on to the vaccines, the big news today is about the REACT study from Imperial College London, which shows, in its words, that coronavirus infections are not falling in England. So what's going on? Well, The Spectator publishes COVID data every day on its new hub at spectator.co.uk/data. And here's editor Fraser Nelson to take us through it. Fraser.
Thank you, Andrew. Yes, the Imperial REACT study is certainly big news. It's one of the biggest studies taken in this country. There's something like 140,000 people who volunteer to be tested. And the findings were, in Imperial's own words, that the rate of new infections was not dropping in the early days of lockdown. Now, this sent shockwaves around quite a few government departments because ministers had thought things were getting better, that the lockdown was doing pretty much what people thought they were going to do, and that they might be lifted in February and we might move back to the tier system. But if this big study contradicted that, then it wasn't quite clear how you can reconcile what it was saying with the official data. Now, let's go back to the start of the current stage in COVID, the Kent variant. We can see that this started to rise during the last lockdown. Now, this was what really worried ministers, that if it could rise throughout lockdown two, what reason was there to think that lockdown three might put a stop to it? So if a new variant had spread, certainly into London, perhaps nationally, you can see a scenario where infections were rising exponentially and even the most forceful tools at the government's disposal wouldn't stop it. That was the concern, and quite a well-justified concern, when lockdown three was announced at the beginning of January. It takes a while for the COVID figures to settle, but let's have a look at what's happened in Kent and in London since then. We've seen a sharp decline in both places of almost 50%. Now, the cases, they can change. What really matters is hospital caseload. So let's look at COVID admissions in London hospitals. We can see them absolutely surging here during December, almost trebling during that month, and reaching a peak of almost 1,000 admissions a day in January the 6th. Now again, let's have a look at what's happened since then. These admissions have fallen to about 650 a day. That's a drop of about a third. Overall, the hospitals are still very stretched. That's true in London, it's true nationally, it's especially true for intensive care units. But we have seen a decline in the number of admissions in London, which was the epicentre of this new variant. Now, let's have a look at England as a whole. You can see there that the positive tests, which again take quite a few days to settle, seem to have peaked at about the new year and then declining. So the same rough trend all around the country. So this is the puzzle. How do we reconcile this official daily data and the hospital data with the Imperial study saying that the virus is not falling? Well, that's a little easier to understand if you look at how the Imperial study takes its data. It does two big samples. The last one was on January the 6th, it started then, but it compares it to the previous sample, which was taken at the end of November and the beginning of December. So the Imperial study missed both the December surge and the January peak. Now, the Imperial REACT study is one of many studies now looking at COVID. There are, for example, we've got the ZOE study run by King's College. They say the number of new COVID infections has been cut in half since the New Year peak. That's one piece of good news. But overall, there's not much good news. We can still see the levels of COVID even now. They're lower than they were in the new year, but they're still far higher, several times higher than they were a few months ago. And we've got the death figures, which always lag infections. They're terrible, and every day we're seeing deaths climb towards almost the peak which we had during the first wave. There is no reason to look at these figures and see any reason to lower your guard. But nor is there any reason to think that things are getting exponentially worse in January, as had been rationally feared at the beginning of the year. Things do seem to be improving, and there does seem to be rational grounds for hoping that when lockdown restrictions are reviewed in the middle of February, we might be able to move back to the tier system.
Fraser, thank you for that. It's fascinating. If you want to keep up on the latest statistics, go to the Spectator Data Hub. If you go to the homepage of the Spectator, you can see a link through, and it's updated on a daily basis with all of the latest figures, and it's a good way to test some of the arguments with the actual hard statistical data that Fraser and his team have arranged there. Fraser Nelson, we'll let you go now, editor of The Spectator. Busy time for you. Let's bring in our political team. James Forsyth, political editor. Katie Bowles, his deputy. James, I was struck again by what you wrote this week, saying that the government's vaccination policy is really its government's economic policy. Explain to our viewers what you mean.
Yes, because the vaccination policy determines how quickly you can reopen the economy. Essentially, there is no hope of getting the economy going properly again until you have vaccinated enough people. Now, I think there will be debates about the timing of when to do that. I think one of the other big changes is there is now a view that the UK is making good progress in the vaccination program, and you've got to protect that. So I think we are looking at much tighter border controls coming in the next few weeks or so. I think even with the government suspending all the travel corridors so that everyone has to have a negative test before they come to the UK, our quarantine rules are still relatively lax compared to other places. You can quarantine in a private residence, for example. I think that is likely to change. We'd like to go down a much more Australian model of you've got to do it in a hotel or some other government-approved facility. And I think this is the question. I think there is a view that just protecting the domestic economy now is the most important thing.
How worried is the government? These reports that the Pfizer, there's been some problems on the supply of the Pfizer vaccine. What's the truth there?
So Pfizer is changing, it's reconfiguring its factory to try and create more vaccine. That has led to a drop in the amount of supply of Pfizer, not just to the UK government, but to everyone. I think that makes meeting the UK's goal of vaccinating 13.5 million people by the 15th of February, that is going to be tighter. I mean, the sense in government is still that they can get there, but they can't afford any more supply issues if they are going to do so. I think it is, though, worth noting that this Pfizer issue is less of a problem for the UK than it is for some other countries, because the UK is not as reliant on Pfizer as some other countries. In it has the Oxford AstraZeneca, a fridge-based vaccine, which is approved, that is easier to roll out logistically. Now, I think if you look at, there were strong numbers yesterday. There was a dip earlier in the week. When you try and understand the dip earlier in the week, I think the clearest explanation I've heard is that some of this is down to the fact that there has been a big priority put this week on vaccinating people in care homes. And that is just not as efficient as these big mass vaccination centres like we've seen at Salisbury Cathedral, where you just bring huge numbers of people through, jab them, and then they move out. And so I think that has been one part of a delay. But I think the 15th of February deadline is tight, but I think the sense is still that they should be able to meet it.
You also write this week, and it's quite a striking sentence or paragraph, is that by the end of spring, which I guess is sometime in May, maybe beginning of May, middle of May, by the end of spring, everyone likely to die from COVID will have been vaccinated. I mean, if that happens, that's a huge advance, James.
Yeah. So Jonathan Van Tam, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, has pointed out that the 28.5 million people or so in that phase one priority group, they account for 99% of deaths and hospitalizations. If you look at the kind of the schedule which is of vaccines, the UK should have been able to vaccinate all of them by, as I say, the end of spring, and with them having had 2 to 3 weeks for that first shot to take effect. I mean, the question then becomes, you know, how do you at that point go big bang and release all of the restrictions, or do you keep some restrictions in place because you worry about mutations in the virus that might occur in this situation? Because this is way beyond my GCSE biology, but as it was explained to me, as you vaccinate more people, the virus comes under more pressure to mutate to survive. And so you don't want a big gap between your moment of vaccinating half the population and having reached kind of vaccine-induced herd immunity. So I think what you will see is them try and speed up the vaccination of the entire population so that you hit that level of vaccine-induced herd immunity as quickly as possible.
Katie, how much pressure is the government now under from its own backbenchers to kind of give a roadmap out of lockdown? Is that still there? We know it has been in the past. Or are they just kind of looking at the vaccination figures and say, let's just concentrate in rolling this out at the moment? What's the dynamic there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some pressure, but to be honest, I do think that if we're looking at that lockdown skeptic group, I think the number in the way has dwindled in terms of the number of Tory MPs really keen to pressurise the government and go public. And I think that's for a few reasons. We've seen really high death tolls this week on a daily basis. I think a lot of people think you actually need to get through this really acute period before you start pressurising too much on a roadmap. I think the daily vaccine numbers help because it does mean that people think they are getting some data. there. So I don't think that is where the main thrust is. And I think we saw last week, I think it was on Thursday, we had Steve Baker send a message to his COVID recovery group comrades saying that we have to get an exit strategy. We're losing support with the people we need. And everyone should get in touch with the whip and say that this is going to become a matter of leadership, ultimately suggesting Boris Johnson's leadership could be in trouble if there was no roadmap. But lo and behold, I think within an hour or so of that story breaking, you had Steve Baker issue a quick retraction on social media saying he had full faith in Boris Johnson. So I think even the most headstrong figures can work out that they may want an exit strategy now. It is not the most effective time to go. I think that's going to be once you hit the first four priority groups, so mid-February you hit the target, yes, potentially an easing. But to be honest, I think the point where the government will move the most or has the potential to, if the side can win the debate, is once you get all the over 50s and you do take out the vast, vast, vast majority of deaths. And I think it's working out when to have that debate, really.
The vaccine isn't just, as James writes, the government's economic policy. It would seem also, Katie, to be Boris Johnson's survival policy. That's what's taken off some of the pressure. We had commented on Spectator TV as the year came to an end that if things didn't get better, there could be some real leadership challenges to Mr. Johnson come the spring or early summer. The vaccine has changed that outlook, hasn't it?
Completely. And I think that even if we get to the spring and we're still under strict restrictions, whether it's at tier three or tier four in lots of areas, I still think his position will be safe. And you're not going to see what we were talking about previously, because there is a roadmap and there'll be a sense of you just need to go this much further and we're getting to a better place. And even, you know, speaking to Redwall MPs recently, one thing I'm picking up is, yes, there's annoyance over universal credit uplift. Yes, that free school meals. There's a few bruising things. But ultimately, what most MPs say their constituents keep talking about is the vaccine rollout. And that's really providing them with some comfort, because that's the thing that is having the most impact. And for once, it is a good news story.
James, you mentioned one of the scary things hovering over this good news story is the fear, I think, in government circles that the virus mutates. And you said it, the more vaccines there, the more it does start to mutate still to keep on going, to evade the vax. That they think the vaccine could be tweaked to accommodate these mutations, but you might need to do that to go back and start vaccinating everybody again, which is the heart sinks of that.
I think you'd face some very difficult questions right now. Right now, there's a simple strategy for vaccination, which is you vaccinate those people who are most likely to die from COVID. If you ended up with a mutation of the virus where the vaccines were considerably less effective, do you go back and give those people the tweaked vaccine, or do you try and give everyone some base level of protection? So the first call on the tweaked vaccine goes to people who haven't had any kind of vaccine yet. I think those decisions are very difficult, very tricky. I think it is striking that Prime Minister's questions yesterday, Boris Johnson was kind of quick to stress, you know, how confident he was that the regulator would approve quickly a tweaked vaccine. This is a point that Matt Hancock made to Fraser and I when we interviewed him for the magazine. You know, I think they have a confidence that they now know more, that if as long as they are just changing the vaccine slightly in the way that they do the flu vaccine, there would not be the same kind of year-long approval process that you had to go through in the first place. But as you say, the logistical challenge of once more vaccinating huge numbers of people would massively retard the economic recovery.
Katie, the other thing James writes about is that even as the vaccine is rolled out to millions and millions more, and there's a sense that the lockdown can begin to be eased in stages, maybe going back in to the tier system again as an interim stage, but the government intends to get much tougher on the border, on the international border. And I can see the logic of that, but what do a lot of people think? Well, why are you only doing it now?
I mean, I think a lot of people have been thinking that for some time when it comes to the government's policy on borders. It's been all over the place. We had a reminder of this week when Priti Patel admitted during a Tory event, I think that she thought was private, but who knows, ultimately that she had actually argued for the borders to close in March. Clearly, that was advice Boris Johnson did not take. But I think everyone in government now accepts there should be a tighter policy. But even, you know, when we tightened it last time, lots of Tory MPs said, this is exactly the point by which we should be opening up. So I think if we get to a point where you have vaccinated the most vulnerable and the government then bring in, for example, what James was talking about, so hotel quarantine, what you have in Australia, I think initially, probably you will have people say, well, if this is what we need for normal life, perhaps that's the way. But I don't think it'll be too long before you start to hear some serious opposition, yes, on the Tory backbenchers, in the sense that the UK is an international hub. I think there are questions about how sustainable that is in the long term. But two, I think in terms of the public as well, I think if you speak to, you know, people who have family in Australia, people who live in Australia, yes, you talk about how they have had many fewer deaths. And I think objectively, that's clearly the best outcome, but it's not a policy that is without pain. And there's lots of stories about how difficult it is having such a strict border policy, similar in New Zealand.
Okay, James, we'll finish up with you on this, just on the politics of it. From the beginning of the pandemic, going way back to March and during the summer into the autumn up to Christmas, there were plenty of opportunities for Labour to act as opposition because so much was going wrong. And they did point it out, but much good did it really do them. The polls have never really given Labour a consistent lead. It's either been a Tory lead or pretty much even Stevens. The job for an opposition, for Keir Starmer's Labour Party, doesn't it now become much harder if the overarching sense of the vaccine is that at last things are beginning to go right?
Yeah, I think if restrictions are lifted in the UK before they are lifted in France or Germany, I think people will think, oh, the government did a pretty good job of handling this crisis, despite the fact that the government has clearly made, as you said, a slew of mistakes in this crisis. And I think the danger for Labour is that there's a kind of recency effect, that what people would remember is the last bit of a crisis where the UK got out of it quicker than other countries. And I think that is the danger for Labour. I think you see this. Some people in the Labour Party are saying that you can't delay the local elections in May, because if you do so, you know, you're trying to get a kind of vaccine bump by delaying the polls to July or September. So they would not be happy with that. I think that is an interesting sign of where politics might be going if the government can manage to get this vaccine rollout right. And you end up in a situation where it was, as Fraser said last week, where the UK is the first country in Europe and one of the first major economies in the world to be able to say, right, we are, you know, even with these restrictions at the border, but we are domestically going back to something very close to normal.
And of course, if it is able to say that, the public may well understand tough restrictions at the border, because if it's going right domestically, you've got to control the border until you're on top of it entirely, and don't screw it up by being too liberal at the border.
Yeah, I mean, there is a sense now that protecting the domestic economy is crucial. I was very struck by speaking to someone who wasn't where I expected them to be on this debate yesterday. And they said, look, the brutal truth is that, you know, it's more important for the economy to be able to keep coffee shops and pubs open than it is to be able to allow, you know, hotshot international business people to come in and do deals. You know, there is a sense that those deals will either be delayed or be done in some other way, maybe on Zoom. You know, but that, you know, that this is a temporary thing, and you know the benefits of reopening this summer domestically fully are worth it. And that just, but I think also the sense that the downside risk of having to do the whole vaccination program again are so high that it is better to err on the side of caution.
Right, James and Katie, we'll leave it there. Thank you for joining us today on Spectator TV. But we're not leaving issues of the vaccine or COVID. We're joined now by Trevor Phillips, Times columnist, former head of the Equality and Human Rights Commission. Trevor, welcome back to Spectator TV. Now, you'll have seen research this week indicating that nearly three quarters of Black Brits wouldn't take the vaccine. Do you think it's really that high?
Yes, I do. I think that there probably is a very high level of vaccine reluctant or vaccine skepticism amongst minorities. And I make the distinction because reluctance is really about lack of knowledge or lack of understanding. Skepticism is something rather more conscious and positive. And I think amongst some minorities, there is a significant level of skepticism. They know perfectly well what's being said about it. They just don't agree with it.
What's the cause of this skepticism, if to use your word? Because it is quite marked. I see from this research, 72% of Black Britons unlikely to get vaccinated, they claim. 42% of those from Pakistan and Bangladesh origin. It's still a high number, but it's a lot lower than 72. But also some quite high, what can I call it, anti-vax sentiment among East Europeans too. Yes. Now, that's quite a varied group from Black Britons to British citizens of Pakistani and Bangladesh origin to those from East European. What's causing this skepticism in your view?
Well, I think there are a couple of things going on here. And I'll just preface it by saying that a big part of this problem is that the government and the authorities have made a big play in the last 6 or 7 months of saying how much they recognize that ethnic minorities are more susceptible or more at risk. Mm-hmm. Actually, they don't know that. They haven't really done the work. We don't know the data. The government says stuff, but actually it can't back it up. And I can go into more detail if you want.
No, I understand
why that's such a big problem. Because it's a big issue in convincing some of these groups. Why do I think that there is vaccine reluctance or skepticism? Well, first of all, I just don't buy this idea that's being put around, and ministers say this, that, oh, it's all about language and the communication's not reaching them. If you look at the ONS data, the proportion of people in this country who do not speak English well enough to understand that kind of information is about 1.3%. The highest level of lack of language proficiency is Bangladeshi women, 5%. So this idea that basically it's all about giving it the information to them in their languages and so on, brackets, they're all a bit backward. I just hate, I really despise it, because actually it's a good way for officialdom to pretend that actually it's the fault of these minority communities. And secondly, what it suggests is that these people just don't know what's going on. If they, you know, if we educated them a bit better, they'd think the same as us. And it's a failure to recognize that actually some of the communities involved just take a different view about risk and about levels of the value of vaccine. And there's one other thing which may explain partly why the Black figure, let's call it, though that covers a whole multitude of kinds of people, is so high. And that is simply distrust of authority. Something similar is true in the United States, where African-Americans are displaying significant levels of resistance to taking the vaccine. And what we think is going on there is very simply, we don't believe you. And actually, everything you've done in the past has really shafted us. And there's one other small point which perhaps we ought to think about, and which, you know, I'm completely pro the vaccine. But one of the questions that one might ask, actually, if you were from some minority backgrounds, is, has this been tested on people like me? And actually what we know about the way that the pharma companies carry out their testing is that they always do have a deficit in the proportion of people from minorities.
You're another distinguished British citizen from a Caribbean background, Jeff Palmer, Sir Jeff Palmer, who was writing in the Mail this week. He also mentioned the issue of trust. He also wrote, and I remain to be convinced about this, in your take, that there were just too many white people up on that stage from public school backgrounds, and that was the reason. Can that really explain 72%?
Well, full disclosure, Jeff has been a family friend, interestingly enough, from the time he was a great friend of my older brother. So I've known him since I was 6 years old, and I have great regard for him. I think he's a, you know, he's a brilliant scientist and so forth. I think he's got it around his neck on this one. I think actually the idea that if you just had a few black faces on the platform, it's a variety of the same thing that actually, if you basically talk to the chiefs, then the chiefs will talk to the Indians and then it'll all be all right. I just think this is nonsense. The truth of the matter is that people are fully conscious by and large of what they're being told, but for substantial reasons, some to do with cultural background, maybe religious beliefs, but also skepticism about what they're being told by any authority in this country, they are not convinced. Why does this matter? Well, it matters because if you're going to remedy that, simply to giving them the same information just in another language isn't going to crack it. You've got to address the fact that people have different points of view. And this, in a way, goes to the heart of a debate that we've been having 20 years about multiculturalism, that, you know, you can all go kumbaya and say, okay, we're all the same under the skin and all the rest of it. But there will come a moment, and we may be coming to one, where what we discover is that there are some people who sincerely believe something which is completely at odds with what the majority of the country believes and what the majority of the country believes to be at odds with the interest of the community as a whole. And at that point, somebody's got to make a decision about how you deal with that.
Well, to ask my favorite Leninist question, what is to be done?
Well, I think the first thing is that we, you know that I bang on about this, we've got to have proper information. I mean, right now, everybody says constantly their minorities are at greater risk. Well, actually, the latest data from the NHS on mortality shows that the proportion of people who have died who are white is 86%, which is exactly the number that white people represent in the population as a whole. So first of all, we need to stop spinning a narrative, which is basically the one that people would like to be true because it solves all sorts of problems, and deal with the facts. And that needs some work. Secondly, and also, if you're going to persuade people, you've got to show them some actual data. So I would say that we first need to understand who is at risk. And secondly, we need to understand better which communities are truly reluctant. Saying black people are more reluctant, which includes Somalis and Ghanaians and Barbadians, who all have completely different outlooks. You know, some might be Muslims, some might be Christians. We need to understand who is really vaccine skeptic and why before we tackle the problem. So I think we need to do a bit more research and be a bit more honest about this before we start throwing solutions, which frankly will have no impact, into the pot.
I mentioned that I was skeptical of Jeff Palmer's complaint about too many public school boys giving out the message. But I do also see there is some validity in giving out messages to particular groups in the manner, in the language, by people that they regard as role models and that they look up to as exemplars of the communities that they come from. And I'm not sure the government has done much or any of that. I mean, I know he's a busy young man with a lot to do already, but someone like Marcus Rashford or Stormzy even, people like that, could they not make a difference if the government got them on side on this?
Only if they actually had a proper answer. I mean, the fact that somebody is black is telling you something that you think is nonsense isn't going to persuade you any more than if somebody is white gives you something, an answer that you think is nonsense. I think whoever the messenger is, we've got to get the message right first. Mm-hmm. And my concern here is that the way we're dealing with this somehow suggests that the only reason that people might be vaccine skeptic is because they just don't understand modern white people's ways. I think we first have to address what is it that they actually are concerned about, and make sure that we actually have a proper answer. By the way, I mean, one of the other things that's being said is it's all about the conspiracy theories that are going around, and that actually somehow minorities are more susceptible to conspiracy theories on Twitter. I mean, give me a break. Give me a break. I mean, you know, we're no more likely to listen to this drivel than anybody else. You know, so first of all, I think the fundamental thing is, I get your point, but the first thing is treat the minority skepticism with the seriousness it deserves. Listen to why people think that there's a problem and answer it scientifically with proper data if we can. Who gives a message, I don't care about? You may be right. Marcus Rashford would be more listened to than anybody else. But actually, I'm not sure that's true. Mm-hmm. I think that the average minority person will say, Marcus Rashford knows about football, but he absolutely does not know about sticking needles in my arm. So the messenger does matter, but what matters more is the message.
I understand. Well, we know government people watch Spectator TV, so I hope they were listening to you, Trevor Phillips, and what you had to say there. Thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure, as always, Andrew. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, our final segment on this week's Spectator TV on Sunday, the Russian opposition politician Alexei Navalny returned home to a regime which had previously tried to poison him. He'd been convalescing in Germany, having survived a botched assassination attempt at the hands of the Russian secret services. Pictures and videos of his arrest as soon as he landed were shared in real time on social media. So was this a brave move? It certainly was, but was it also stupid? Owen Matthews, he's a veteran Russian reporter, author of Stalin's Children. He writes for The Spectator on Russian matters, and he's written about what's been happening this week in the current edition of The Spectator. Owen, welcome to Spectator TV. I mean, let me just come straight to the question that everybody's asking who hasn't been following this in detail. He knew what they tried to do to him. They almost killed him. He managed to get out. He managed to recuperate in Berlin, and he went straight back again. Why?
Hello, Andrew. Good to see you. He's a fighter. He is a proud man. I think he's in many ways a vain man. Not to take away in any way, not to detract from his extraordinary bravery in doing this. But I think the real question is he really going to prove anything with this great act of self-destruction that Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the oligarch whom Putin jailed back in 2003, didn't already prove? And you can see in his court hearing, the first court hearing, he said, this is a travesty of justice. This is ridiculous. And I think a lot of Russians who saw that thought, well, yes, we knew that. You knew that. Why do you need to show that to us again? And most importantly, how are you going to help your cause by spending, you know, the next 3, 10, who knows, years in jail?
I mean, you point out in your article that, I mean, he hasn't just gone back into the lion's den, if that phrase ever had a meaning. What he's done is going back into the lion's den. He was even taunting President Putin on social media. You report saying, here's President Putin stamping his little feet at the prospect of my return. I mean, that's remarkable.
Well, and since then, since the magazine came out, he actually doubled down on that, because after his arrest, his team released yet another video, probably his most ambitious and most extraordinary one yet, which had already been prepared. He'd clearly spent a lot of time preparing this, and it's all about Putin's personal wealth. About in detail, with all the accounts, with all the holding companies, with the names of how a gigantic palace on the Black Sea coast personally belongs to Putin, about apartments that he'd bought for his mistress's mothers, for his illegitimate daughter. I mean, it's absolutely mind-blowingly provocative and extraordinary, shocking. It's an absolute journalistic bombshell. But now, I mean, knowing that that was about to come out immediately after his return to Russia, it just makes the whole thing all the more extraordinary. And I think it just proves that he was clearly doing this in order to make himself a martyr. He was not in any way expecting Putin not to react. He did everything to provoke Putin into putting him in jail.
Now, he was jailed before in 2013. There were then quite a lot of demonstrations in some cities after that, and he was then released after that on certain conditions. But you think times have changed this time? You think that Mr. Putin and the Kremlin, that's not going to happen again, that they are really ready to throw the book at him this time?
They certainly are. I mean, I think that it was amply demonstrated even in December. It was no surprise. Even in December, the prosecutor's office announced that they were opening a new criminal case. Immediately after his return, they opened in yet another one because he's apparently defamed a war veteran, because a war veteran was one of the people whom he quoted as supporting Putin, said these people are traitors. I mean, they're just piling on more and more and more accusations, and Navalny clearly knew that, quite apart from having been in a coma for 20 days, having been poisoned by the FSB. So I think the calculation is he thinks that the Kremlin is going to, just like in 2013, be somehow cowed or scared by street demonstrations. Now, in 2013, Russia was gearing up to the Winter Olympics. And it's going to be in the world's eye. Putin, like all authoritarians, loves these sort of giant international set pieces more than anything. And he didn't want to have any kind of embarrassment, which is why he released Mikhail Khodorkovsky before the Sochi Olympics. This is why he handed down a suspended sentence to Navalny before the Winter Olympics in 2014. But sadly for Navalny, there are no Olympics this year.
Yes, exactly. Well, he must have known at the back of his mind, or even at the front of his mind, that there's a huge risk that he is just stuck in the slammer for as far as the eye can see in some godforsaken Russian jail, prison somewhere. And that to the very least was a possibility, if not a probability. Now, given that that was perhaps a probability, what could he hope to achieve if that was to happen? What can he achieve being in some miserable jail 500 miles from Moscow?
The most surprising thing about this calculation is that hitherto Alexei Navalny has actually been a very brilliant strategist in terms of how to overcome Putin's power, because both tactically and strategically. So, for instance, he's very carefully not taken really any sort of major political positions. So the way he's positioned himself has been as a critic of official corruption. And that's a universal message. He's not going to alienate anyone except for, you know, particularly stupid and sort of mindless patriots who say, like, no, you know, our leaders are completely clean and they never steal anything. I mean, you won't find anyone in Russia who says that. But Navalny has not positioned himself as a national politician. He's positioned himself as an anti-corruption campaigner. And that's been sort of strategically very smart. And tactically, he's been very smart because what he's done in various provincial cities, and is what he was working on when he was poisoned, was one of his devastatingly effective videos on the municipal elections in Novosibirsk. And long story short, with just 150,000 votes, focused on opposition candidates, United Russia, Putin's party, could lose control of Russia's third largest city. So what his campaign, he calls it smart voting. In other words, uniting protest voting behind one opposition candidate, and you log on, you find out who is the most likely to win. Everyone votes for him, they win. That is actually extremely tactically smart way of bringing down United Russia. I mean, it's hard to bring down Putin because he's, you know, so this godlike figure. There's no plausible alternative. But in terms of actually really eroding the base of the Kremlin's support and the Kremlin's power, Alexei Navalny has hitherto gone about it in exactly the right way. Now, everyone is baffled, is that what he's done now, as you rightly say, he's going to be in jail for several years, everyone expects. His last video that he put up, the one that I mentioned earlier about Putin's palaces, got 30, I checked yesterday evening, had 31 million views on YouTube. 31 million views. That's one third of the voting population of Russia. I mean, that's extraordinary reach. That's devastatingly effective, although, of course, not all those views were from within Russia, of course. But nonetheless, I mean, he's hitherto actually been a really dangerous and smart opponent, and now he's actually seems to have just done a catastrophic misstep. And I think the only reason that I can think of is that he believes that he his moral authority from inside jail will somehow spread and keep him in the news, and his suffering will, in a rather like a sort of Tolstoyan or probably more likely Dostoevskyan character, his movement will be ennobled by his martyrdom. But in practical terms, I'm not really sure. I think you're completely right. A silenced Navalny is a powerless Navalny. And he's brought that on himself.
Tell us just a bit about how Russians regard Mr. Navalny. I mean, is he a household name? Is he still a household name if you leave the big cities? Is he regarded as a martyr? Is he seen as this sort of fearless crusader for truth? What do most Russians, what's the consensus view, you think, of him inside the country?
Well, the most shocking poll was done by the Levada Center, which is the only thing close to as an independent polling station, and they and they found in December that only 19% of Russians actually think that Navalny was poisoned because he was an opposition candidate. Because he was in opposition to the Kremlin. 30% thought that he'd poisoned himself. A further around 20 to 30% thought that he that it was all sort of some kind of complicated provocation by the West. I mean, the basic problem with Navalny, which you correctly identify in your question, is that beyond the cities, he's not really that very well known, and certainly not to those people who still rely on state television as their main source of information. I mean, Vladimir Putin literally, and rather actually now comically, for a decade has refused to say his name, like Lord Voldemort. That the name Navalny has never passed the lips of Vladimir Putin. That's just never happened. And if you watch Russian state television, as I have been the last few days, you know, it's as though it never happened. And I've been corresponding, with literally dozens of friends and acquaintances, not just in Moscow and Petersburg, but all over Russia. And for them, what struck me most of the many responses is that even people who are quite sympathetic towards Navalny with his anti-corruption message say he's an idiot. Like, how can somebody who has so little regard for his own liberty and his own, you know, and his own well-being be a leader that we can look up to? Because he didn't, his principled stand comes across, sadly, to many Russians because they've been so permeated by this culture of cynicism that has been very deliberately promulgated by the Kremlin and its critics, this sort of nihilism. They just think, like, you know, what an idiot. Like, you know, doesn't he know the rules? Didn't he know what was going to happen? Like, you know, yes, the system is rotten. You know, we knew that. They steal. Yes, we knew that too. So the biggest problem for Navalny and his future and the future of his campaign is this sort of terrible cynicism. And in this, in returning and being imprisoned, I think he's actually, he's gained the respect of people who look up to martyrs and are fans of Lev Nikolaevich Tolstoy and so on. But for just as many people think that he's just, you know, a fool. And he's actually lost respect among lots of people because, you know, he was very clear. He, you know, as you said right at the beginning of this conversation, like, he survived, he made it. He managed to, by a whisker, survive this horrific poisoning attempt and was home free. He was in Berlin. Like, why would you come back after that? And I think for the majority of Russians, I think that sort of that sort of relegated him to the status of some kind of, hysterical religious, almost religious martyr. Obviously, in the cities, which are the politically important part, there are the urban intelligentsia who think that he's a hero and will come out this Saturday on the streets and will doubtless have their heads cracked. But sadly, that's still a rather small majority, a minority, I beg your pardon.
Well, listen, thank you for that. We're going to leave it there. Thank you for your excellent piece in The Spectator this week, and for marking our card on what's happening. It's a fascinating tale. I didn't even go around to the fact that the FSB seemed to smear the Novichok on his underpants. And even then didn't, I mean, you couldn't make that up, could you? Owen, thank you very much. Owen Matthews there. That's it for this week. Thanks to all of our guests. And once again, to our very special sponsor, Charles Stanley. Their continuing support for The Week in 60 Minutes is much appreciated. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest firms in the London Stock Exchange. We're delighted to have them as partners here at Spectator TV. A final reminder, if you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel, it's free. You'll never miss another episode. You just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen now. As always, please send any thoughts to us at spectatortv@spectator.co.uk. That's spectatortv@spectator.co.uk. Join us again next week. Bye-bye.